So what I'm going to do today is discuss a few case studies. I want to, of course, thank my two PhD students, Greg Bruin, who is now at Principal College and was worked with me for many years and continued after he graduated, and Scott Winton, who is a current student, both of them doing some pretty interesting work, to say the least. So I'm going to show you, if you're looking at restoration characteristics that you should consider. I can't cover all of these, but obviously one of the key ones is soil type variability. And we have a great spatial program, a geospatial program at Duke. You'll see this is going to play an important role because not many people have looked at that. So the spatial variability between wetland type soils and also natural versus restored. Soil organic matter, of course, microtopography and hydroperiod, I'll cover with some case examples. And how that affects some of the soil texture and bulk density. And then, of course, this would in turn affect nutrient availability, which in turn also, of course, affects the microbial communities. And then, of course, if you do have problems with toxic metals or salts, which I won't cover, but a little picture down there shows you quite a variation in some of the soils you might have. So the case studies that I'm going to look at, I'm going to do first an observational study we did for the state, which has about 300 restoration sites. And this has to do with the fight of whether you do a restoration in watershed, in kind, or out, and you can see what you're looking at for a goal if you go outside. Looking at created versus natural, and then secondly, I'll do some spatial analysis, showing the importance of that spatial variation. And then thirdly, a couple of experiments that we actually looked at microtopographic reestablishment and its role, hydroperiod reestablishment and its role, and then some organic amendments and the role that it would have on some ecosystem functions. So first we'll take a look at sort of the observational one, and this is kind of a quick study, but it was took a little bit of work to find these sites. So we went to the coast of North Carolina, and there are 12 sites in here, and we basically tried to match up restoration sites with reference sites throughout the whole coastal plain of North Carolina. These sites that are restored were between 3 and 9 years old. So when you just lump all of those sites together, as you might do, you end up with the blue will always be the natural wetlands, and the red will be the restored or created. Here, just looking at soil organic matter, you can see there is a statistical difference. But you're really looking at the hydrogeomorphic subclasses that people would look at as really critical, because if you start to look at that, you would look at, for example, headwaters over here, non-mineral, for example, this is the organic surface forested systems. Quite a range. Here's non-riverine, here's riverine, mineral. So there's quite a range in those systems and significant difference if you look at that. And if you actually look across the whole range of the sites on the coastal plain, you can see, sure, all of the restored sites are less in organic matter, but also there's quite a range of what the natural systems would have and would have to be taken into account. And in fact, all of those with the green circles around them are very significantly different. That would have to be taken into account, which says if you're going to do a mineral flat versus a headwater one, you need to know roughly what your reference system would be like just for this one, and of course differs from some of the other characteristics. So that's just one example. So now if we want to take a look at some of the summaries of that, sites significantly differed in this, much lower in the restored. Low levels and restored may hinder development and so on. So you need to really look, as I said, at those systems. Now, geostatistically, if you want to look at the spatial variability of soils, people don't do this very often because it's very expensive, it's time consuming. You have to take a lot of samples. And sometimes before we had sort of modern approaches to geospatial analysis, it was pretty tough to deal with. So let's take a look at a conceptual overview of the next few slides. And so let's say we have the conceptual overview of how the rest of the data will be presented from a number of our studies here. So if you start out with your natural and your restore, you can see, let's say, whatever value you're looking at, organic matter or pH or something, you would say, well, this is what we have after we restored the system. But you'd like to get at some future value in a reasonable amount of time, something closer to a match. That's sort of the view of that. But geospatially, what you may really have, if you look across that, say, 2-acre or 10-acre site, is the fact the restored wetland, let's say if you look at some value, say, like pH or organic matter, you may have very low levels of this component in the restored, And the distribution, the frequency distribution, is quite different across that site, and that's why you have a lot of vegetation failures, that's why you have a lot of replantings, that's why you have a lot of problems. When you really like to do is to make sure your restored site, the frequency distribution of whatever character you're looking at, characteristic, is more evenly distributed compared to the natural one. And if you want to look at that, I like visual things, you'd say, well, presently after restoration, it looks like that, whatever it is, and you would hope that you could get to something more like this. And how long would that take to get to that particular point? So let's take a look at some hypotheses and some objectives. So we wanted to create these soils of created wetlands will exhibit less heterogeneity than soil ones. That's not a mind bender there. Because of prior land use activities, agriculture, disturbance, they're usually more homogeneous, especially if you take the soil off. So we wanted to compare four sites that were created and restored to sort of their natural counterpart. And again, we go back to the North Carolina coast. This time we pick specific sites, and we do some interesting sampling. This is a sampling that looks like it's not a pattern, but actually it is a clustered centroid pattern. Normally when you do, when I learned it, you would do a transect and you would stop every random distance and take a point and take a sample. But this type of sampling, this clustered centroids, allows you to pick a central point and then actually take within, say, 8 meters of that central point, four different compass points, these red dots, which allows you to do both near and far comparisons to do a true geospatial analysis. You cannot do that with a normal, regular sampling procedure. So let's take a look quickly at the sites. You can just see a picture of Rowell Branch, which is a headwater riverine. This is the restored. This is the natural site. Here's Gremsland. This is a main stem riverine. I don't have a picture of the other part. This is what we call ABC, which is not the liquor store, by the way. This is the restored site. This is the natural site. And this is a non-riverine mineral soil flat. And here is the Dismal Swamp. And this one is different because this one is an organic site. The rest are mineral sites. So we're really comparing a lot of different types of sites, and we're going to see how this plays out. So here we can see, again, the restored non-riverine organic soil flat there. Now let's take a look at those same kinds of patterns and see if we got a frequency distribution across any of these features. So if we just look quickly at something like at bulk density, remember this is organic site, Dismal Swamp. These are the mineral sites, headwater and not, and riverine and not. You can see right away bulk density, as you'd expect, the higher bulk densities are all in the restored site. That's what you would might expect. And the natural sites are lower. But for some of the other features, you get the reverse. Here you see soil organic matter. Soil organic matter is lower in the restored sites compared to the natural. And the pH, however, is fairly evenly distributed for some, but not for others. And, of course, here you can see, again, there's a variation with the natural sites being on the lower side of this. Now let's take a look again this way, and I think you get a better idea. So let's take a look at the middle ones first here. And you can see the restored sites on the left. If you're looking at soil organic matter down here, about percentages 0 to 4 to 8 in the blue, you can see both the ABC site and the GL site are pretty uniform, but definitely much different than the spatial distribution of the natural sites. If you look up here at the RV riverine site, again, you can see something quite interesting. The created restored site has more diversity, in a sense, of spatial variation than the natural, but much lower organic matter. And then the Dismal Swamp down here, you can see something interesting too. The Dismal site actually has a variation in organic matter, again low, compared to the natural site is more uniform. So you're going to get a surprise on some of this if you think it's all going to be one way. It depends on what type of system you are working on. So this tells you what your goals are, and this tells you how far you've gotten. If you look at some other characteristics like moisture, you can see here they're actually pretty uniform. You've restored the hydrology, which is the number one thing people say. If you get the hydrology right, plant the right species, it'll be fine. So on these, you get a distribution that's pretty good, except the Dismal Swamp. And the Dismal Swamp, turns out it has a lower, but a much more uniform distribution than the restored site. It has a variety across here of organic moistures. The nitrates, you can see again, the natural sites have more nitrate. You'd expect that. The ammonia, the pattern's a little bit uniform. And then you've got the soil organic carbon. But look at this way, and you can see, what does the created site look like? Here you can see the created versus the natural in terms of nitrate. The natural sites have much higher distributions and much higher amounts. These sites have all been disturbed or soil taken off or affected. And so again, their spatial pattern is much lower. If you look at something like now denitrification, a function, what is your denitrification rate after, say, 6 to 8, 9 years? And you can see the denitrification rate potential here, again, is lower in the created restored sites than it would be in some of the natural sites here, which are mineral, where you have some hot spots. And that's to do, again, with the amount of nitrates you have in the system. So, geostatistically, land use management may increase or decrease some of the spatial variability. Land use and management appears to homogenize certain soil properties, but it's somewhat difficult unless you know what the reference site is. They can be different. Sometimes they'll go up, sometimes they'll go down. Uniform random sampling will not allow you to do this type of analysis. You have to do more of this clustered spatial analysis. And then we think if you really want to have better success, we've had a number of sites in North Carolina where one half of the site, the vegetation survived, did well, grew well. The other side, everything died, not once, not twice, but three times. And it has to do when you look at the soils. If they had looked at the soils across that site, they would have seen a completely different array of soil properties from left to right. So this, if they had known that, they would have planted different species and done some different things. So let's quickly look at a couple of quick trials. Here's an experimental restoration series, microtopography, hydroperiod, and organic. So Greg and I, a number of years ago, this was a key part of his dissertation, we went to a site where they purposely, in the state of North Carolina, said, okay, let's add hollows, flats, and hummocks to see if it makes a difference. So we looked at that site, and we hypothesized that the hollows would be wetter, obviously, and we would have conditions for better denitrification, because it would have less oxygen. But the plants would grow better on sites that were sort of in the zone with intermediate moisture, and that we would get the most growth in the wettest sites since these dry out during the summer. So we go back to our ABC site, and we can see these areas. Again, with our design here, we have hummocks and flats and hollows that we're now sampling separately. And the results are pretty interesting. First, let's look at the hollows. Obviously, these are wetter because they are lower. And this, of course, the flats are intermediate. And then the other ones, I don't have it on this graph, but of course, would follow, even be drier. So let's take a look at soil temperatures. It follows very much what you'd expect. The hollows are cooler all year long. The higher sites are drier. If you look at the soil moisture, the hollows are wetter, and the high sites are drier, and the flats are intermediate. So that's the conditions you created. And what did we get? We got basically what we thought we would get. The most number of species diversity was in the flat area here, and so those were significant. And the biomass was significantly different, with the greatest biomass growing in the wettest sites. And the lowest, of course, on the hummock, the dry sites, we had a lot of problems with vegetation. If you look at denitrification, we would have hypothesized that we would get a higher rate in the hollows. We did. It wasn't significant due to large variability in measuring that, but it's definitely the trend that you're getting. So microtopography makes a big difference. So now, going back to the Duke campus, we have a place we've restored all the streams and wetlands on campus. One of our projects was to establish longer hydroperiods so that we could enhance the wetland plant communities. And this is done this way. On urban systems around the country, Duke and Durham is no different, we have streams because of all the high urban runoff that have eroded down these streams 6, 8, and 9 feet in depth. Don't have time to go through that whole restoration project. You can look at our website and come up with that information. We've got a lot of papers on that. You bury that stream, you build a new stream. This is a totally new created stream based on a reference reach. You can see riffles and pools. You can see root wads here. And importantly, we created terraces, a low bench and a high bench terrace. The creek is over here. This wasn't planted. These are all natural cattails that came in. This is a diversity of species. And if you look at the hydrologies, we basically, this is a 30 centimeter below. This site had water tables in the summertime 1 meter below the surface. So we've reestablished, this is the surface here, in both the low and the high bench, we've created water well above 10, 15 centimeters during the growing season, all well above in that 10 to 15 zone, and many times during storms above the surface. In fact, you saw that here, you can see the standing water after a storm on the low bench, not on the high bench. So we have water table recorders in all of these sites with the circles. These all meet all the hydroperiod requirements for the wet sites that we have. Here is the recreated stream. And all I'm going to show you is only one slide from the data, but this basically shows you 5 year of community responses published in 2013. Here's the low marsh with the species number going up. And these A, B, C, D refer to various plot regions in that zone. And in the high marsh, you can see species going down. I always ask my students why do they think that is. And without giving them enough information, of course, they can't figure out why that is. Basically, what we have is wetland species increasing in number up here, basically starting down here as low as 8 or 9, going up to almost 25. Upland species dying out due to this flooding condition. We also had one interesting finding with this. Microstegium, one of the greatest invasives we have, died out in these plots due to the flooding, which was a find we hadn't expected. So I'll finish up with another example here, and this is the effect of long-term organic matter amendments on greenhouse gases. This is part of a larger study, and Lee is going to talk after me. I don't know how much he's going to cover this.
A little bit.
So I won't spend much time on it, except to show you a picture in, I think, 2001. Here's a picture last year, what it looks like in the fall, winter, and the summer. So it's grown quite nicely, and this site was set up by Lee for a dry and a wet blocks. And essentially, they're adding no organic matter as a compost, all the way up to 336 megagrams or tons per hectare on a basis that is set up in wet and dry blocks. So we came in later to look at, after Lee had studied this, a perfect setup. He was gracious enough to let us come to his sites. And we wanted to look at things, what happened over time with bulk density, what happened with denitrification, we think will increase, what happened to phosphorus absorption, and then in greenhouse gases, what would happen to things like methane. There's a huge fight in the wetlands community right now that wetland restoration on mineral sites will result in huge fluxes of greenhouse gases like methane, and they will actually contribute to the global climate change problem. One side argues that's not true, they'll have a crossover point, they'll become a sink. So we wanted to look at a site that actually had organic matter or not and see what happens over the long term. So Greg and I, early on, we published some of the stuff in 2009 here, you can see the bulk density did exactly what we'd expect, both on the wet and dry sites. As you add more organic matter, of course, the bulk density goes down. If you look at the phosphorus sorption, it also follows that because you're having less interaction with mineral and organic matter is not a great binder of phosphorus. The decomposition rate does basically go up for denitrification rate, I should say. And there's a difference between wet and dry sites, as you would expect. And, however, the maximum peak we got was at about 56 to 112 megatons, megagrams per hectare. So there is a range, and so the organic matter is having an obvious effect on that. So over time, which is the last part of my talk here, you can see the organic matter loading. And this was from one of the students that published with Lee here. I think his name was Daniels. This was his line for organic matter after 2005. Total soil carbon that was in the soil with all of these addition rates. So we come back in 2011, and you can see, obviously, some of this is oxidized away. And you expect that. And it's been decomposed. So question is, what did this do to greenhouse rates, and what effect does this have over time? Because now we're over a decade. So let's take a look at, first of all, do we get methane? Well, we get methane in the wet sites, and we only get much methane because, of course, if you have oxygen, you oxidize it. So you do get methane when you have water contents in the 50 to 70% range. So we do get methane. If you look at seasonal gas fluxes, however, what you see, and you'll see in a minute, most of your gas fluxes are actually CO2. So here we see during a growing period for 2 years, zero organic matter down here is at the bottom. At the top is the 336, and you can see they follow right in line the amount of CO2, seasonal gas flux, after 2011, 10 years plus years, follows exactly what the organic loading rates were with the compost. So it's still there, and the rates are comparable to what they were original. And then when you put them in finally in equivalence, total greenhouse gas flux in relationship to organic matter loadings and CO2 equivalents, a couple of things pop out. Where most of the organic matter is, yes, you get more CO2, but the proportion of methane in any of those conditions is less than 10%. It's not, the organic matter has, there's no significant relationship between the amount of organic matter that was added and the increase in methane. And the proportion of methane stays about the same throughout the whole system. So these systems are not big methane generators. So, in conclusion, reestablishment of hydroperiod removes the upland plant species and increases wetland composition. No big surprise. Microtopography creates the zones you want, and you get the functions you think you might get in terms of conditions, in terms of diversity and biogeochemical. Soil organic matter amendments are positive for plants, bulk density, denitrification are sort of negative for sorption. And there is probably an optimum loading rate for this, somewhere around the 50 to 100. And finally, this says that your amendment recommendations might be created sites should consider both organic amendments to meet success. They should consider microtopographic establishment. They should really have more concerns for these adaptive conditions than we do. And in some cases, this topsoil probably should be saved, or in a lot of cases, it's not. And we need to look at the regional adaptive conditions to set proper conditions for those natural versus created systems. And I'll leave you with what my students, all the years working with me, have found the one key species that indicates success. If you have this species, you've got success. My students gave me this, so. Everyone's asking me, is this a natural native species or not? I can't answer that.
We can take one question.
I have a question about your approach to looking at your centroid sampling and looking at the geospatial kind of pictures that you made. Would you recommend doing that for maybe monitoring or even picking potential sites? It seems like a really good way you could go out incrementally and sample and see if you're obtaining your original reference site.
That's exactly what we would recommend. It's what we do now. We actually recommend that they take, it takes a little bit more sampling, but for a few things like organic matter stuff, it's not that big a deal. Because you're only adding, like all those X's that were in there, we did not do a centroid in every X. We did it only one-third of the X's on those. So therefore, and they're still allowed to do the geospatial. That tells you a lot about the variability. And you can actually do that pretty nicely. It isn't as difficult. And then, of course, the programs are pretty easy to run, and then you can actually produce those maps pretty easily.
Are a lot of people doing that?
Not enough, I don't think. I think this is, as I say, this is when we presented this and Greg first did this work, people were kind of in awe. They were saying, well, we used to just do 15 straight lines, and that seemed to work pretty well. This allows you so much more power to do almost anything with vegetation, nutrients, organic matter, the minerals conditions. You'd get a lot better success if you knew if your site's, especially for little tiny sites is one thing, but for big sites, the soil variability is quite great across those sites.